Support for this KQED podcast comes from Walmart Labs, based in Silicon Valley. Powered by its own open source technology, Walmart Labs engineers code in an agile DevOps environment. Learn more about engineering and big data positions at walmartlabs.com.
Well, you're hearing some music from musical theater, and there's a musical theater down in the South Bay since 1995. Natak has been staging plays in the South Bay, and the theater company identifies itself as the largest Indian theater in the United States. That's Indian as in South Asia, by the way, and its latest musical production is called Vrindavan, and it takes a close look at really the politics and social ills behind the city of Vrindavan, where widows are sent to live after their husbands die. And we welcome the playwright and artistic director, Suji Saraf, to this segment of the Forum Program.
Morning. Glad to be here, Michael.
Delighted to have you here. And, we should talk about the genesis of this. You're a techie. These are techies who established this theater. Yeah?
Yes, we are techies. Our standard joke is that we represent a combined market cap of $3 trillion, once you add Google and Apple and all those companies. We are engineers who do this in our spare time, but do it very, very seriously.
Yes, I know you do, and you're quite dedicated to it, and I find that impressive. You've got both sides of your brain working, and congratulations on the success you've had. Originally, this was, I guess, done largely from students at Stanford and at UC Berkeley?
Yes, it began when I was a graduate student at Berkeley and a close friend at Stanford. We had done some theater in India, and we thought it would be lovely to recreate those days. So these were pre-social media days, 1995. We posted some emails on those news groups that used to exist. And that's how the company began. We began to do plays one after another.
And now you've got all the social media behind you. And we should mention that it started as kind of a Hindi company. I mean, the plays were largely Hindi. Now you're doing the E.M. Forrester thing, trying to maybe make the connection.
Yes, we do. I guess we like to say we have two lives. We have lives that we led in India before we came to the United States in our early 20s, very impressionable years, and our lives in America. So most of our plays tend to be from our lives in India. But a small minority, perhaps an increasing minority, are now plays about our lives and experiences here.
And you are originally from Bihar?
I am from, it's very complicated, but yeah, I was born and raised in the badlands of India, the state of Bihar, yes.
And Bengali?
Bihar is a state right next to Bengal, where most of the widows in Vrindavan are from.
Let's talk about those widows. I mean, it goes back to Lord Krishna, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So widowhood in India for centuries has been brutal, terrible, and in large parts of India still is terrible. The widow was vaguely suspected of being responsible for her husband's death. She was morally suspect. She's a single, unattached woman. And sometime in the future, she might lay claims on the husband's share of the family property. For these reasons, she was usually shunned, discouraged from looking good, you know, their head was shaved. They were not allowed to wear ornaments. And some of them, particularly from the regions of Bengal, were dispatched to the city of Vrindavan in northern India.
No wonder these women threw themselves in the Ganges. I mean, I don't mean to make light of this by any means or bring levity
yes,
to it.
Yes, it could be a very brutal life. But
horrible.
Of course, that was the only life they knew.
They couldn't wear anything ornamental. They were, in many cases, particularly as your play points out, forced into prostitution.
Yes. And I don't want to oversimplify the matter. Naturally, in cities and in some pockets, this is not true. But in large parts of India, it still is. Now, Vrindavan is a city that looms large in the Indian consciousness because it is where the Lord Krishna spent his childhood and teenage years. He romanced thousands of milkmaids, stole their clothes when they were bathing in the river Yamuna, slew a dozen demons, including this dreaded serpent and so on, and romanced this one milkmaid named Radha.
But also romanced about 16,000 women.
Yes, he did. Time. He's the great lover in Indian culture. And I like to think that almost all Indian romantic stories, including all Bollywood film stories, are informed by this great love of Krishna and Radha. Almost all Indian love songs celebrate this great love. So the idea is that these widows are all married to the Lord Krishna, and they go and spend the rest of their lives servicing him, worshipping him. But in reality, of course, they've been banished. Some beg in the streets. Some live in squalid government-run widow homes. Some, a small minority, do turn to prostitution. And at some point, they die. Nobody really wants them. Now, that brings us to modern times. what happened last year was India witnessed a watershed election, which led to India's first right-wing full majority government in parliament, and its leader, Narendra Modi, became prime minister. Incidentally, Narendra Modi will be speaking in San Jose.
And incidentally, we did a whole program on that election, which is in our archives.
Wonderful.
I'd like to promote that. But also, it plays into your drama. I mean, you've got a major scandal with the woman who was elected to parliament in 2014.
Yes. So that woman is Hema Malini from Mr. Modi's party. She is your standard alabaster skin Indian film actress. You know, Indians have a fascination for white skin, but that's a topic for another day. I don't want to go into it. I did a whole play on that last year.
I do have a question about that, but please proceed.
Okay. So Hema Malini is now a retired film star. When I was growing up, she was the biggest film star in Bollywood. We all of us knew her as the Dream Girl, because that was the name of one of her better-known movies. You know, her porcelain skin, unbelievably beautiful. She's now perhaps 65 or 66. After becoming the congresswoman representing Vrindavan, she visited a widow home last year and made a very innocuous-sounding remark saying, why do these widows come to Vrindavan? Why don't they stay in Bengal where they are from? Now, she's not a politician. And it was actually a very well-meant remark, not a malicious one, because then she went on a dozen TV shows and I heard her out and she meant it well. What she did not realize is that she became caught in a left-wing, right-wing tug of war, because Bengal is ruled by this strident left-wing woman who, of course, took up cudgels on behalf of all Bengalis. And it became a left-wing, right-wing quarrel. And I heard about this. Well, it was all over the news. I imagined a beautiful play in which this Bollywood actress with porcelain skin lands in the middle of my poor widows and announces a deportation scheme for their benefit, of course. They will be sent back to their families in Bengal. Their families don't want them, by the way. And my widows, powerless as they are, fight back with whatever little they've got. That's what the play is about. But now this is Vrindavan. So the play is wrapped in the beautiful love of Krishna and Radha, Indian classical music, classical dance. That love is extremely colorful. People throw color in the air and so on. And that love is juxtaposed with the stark existence of Indian widows who are all dressed in white, are poor, penniless, and have nowhere to go and are now being thrown out of the only home they have known for decades.
How imaginative for a man associated with Lockheed Martin. This would not be the expectation.
Yes.
Suji Sarif is here in the studio, a novelist, playwright, originally from India, and artistic director of Natak, which is a theater and film company in Santa Clara. He wrote and will be directing his new production, which, as you've heard, is Vrindavan, and his novel The Peacock Throne was shortlisted for the Encore Prize in London, and another, The Confession of Sultana Daku, is being made into a motion picture. Peacock Throne sounds like Iran, of course, to think of the Pahlavi family.
Yes, the Pahlavi family, the Iranian royal families were known as the Peacock Throne. That is because they were named after the original Peacock Throne, which was an actual throne on which the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan sat in the Red Fort in India. So, in fact, the Iranian term derives from the Indian term.
And this is also, this new play of yours, it's about women in power, too. I mean, it's about what I suppose could be called feminist motifs. Yeah.
It could be called that. I usually shun the term feminism because I sometimes find, while I perhaps I'm a feminist myself, I'm certainly a left-of-center type guy, I find some feminist arguments to be very simple-minded. And I find it very annoying when Western feminists apply their ideas across culture and geography and time to countries like India. My mother has passed away. My own mother, by the standards of Western feminism, would be called an oppressed woman. She was not very literate. She was married, of course, without being consulted. And naturally, my father was the primary ruler, if you want to use that word, in the family. Yet, I, of course, knew my mother and as an extremely happy woman with a very fulfilling life. So I perhaps am a feminist. I'm, of course, a Western liberal, if you will. But I shun the term because of its simple-minded application to the world. So I like to think that Vrindavan is a play about women's power rather than women's rights. My women in the play, although powerless, fight back with the little power that is always available to people, no matter how oppressed.
Well, as long as we're talking about controversial subjects like feminism, I'm going to go back to skin color here for a moment, because you said at one point in every Indian's heart feels white.
That was what I told the Times of India last year.
So what did you mean by that?
Yes, Indians have this self-image. My Indian listeners won't like my saying this, but of course it's true. Indians have this self-image that because they are perhaps trained a little bit in English, in a way, let's say, the Chinese are not. Indians in India often compare themselves to China, to the Chinese, who by most metrics seem to be doing better. Indians have this self-image that we are somehow whiter. I'll give you an example. Suppose there is a bomb blast in India, and a police artist then interviews witnesses and draws a sketch of the bomb suspects. I tell you, those sketches will look white. They will be of white people. Then the actual guy will be caught, and you will find that he looks nothing like the sketches. He's very, very Indian looking. I grew up with posters on the walls of my home of Gandhi and Nehru and Subhash Chandra Bose. These are Indian political leaders. They are all white skinned. They all have pink lips. I can assure you they look nothing like that. So Indians have this image that we are somehow whiter than other brown-skinned people. And I always find that very, very interesting. So I did an entire play last year in which I inverted this value and I created a world where white skin was considered so hideous that if you gaze at a woman with white skin, you fall asleep for 3 days. and into that weird world, a woman is born who happens to be white and so on. I'll go on and on, so I'll stop there.
We're talking with Sujit Saraf, and let me bring our listeners into this. We have a lot of Indian listeners. They may indeed want to respond to some of the things that you've put out here, provocative as they may be, and also you may want to join our conversation. If you do, you can do it now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, not just Indians, obviously, if you want to talk about this exciting theater, which is full of dance and music and color and spectacle and is right here in the South Bay. Or if you have some questions you'd like to bring to the fore, feel free to join the program. Again, that toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org. If you have something to add or a question or comment, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. There's also, I mean, when we talk about feminism, it gets us a little off kilter here, but a lot has been made out of the rapes recently in India, and there's a lot of concern about just sexualizing women and violence against women with good reason. I mean, some of it is pretty
dreadful. Yes, with good reason. Now, all cultures sexualize women. We are sitting in a country which sexualizes women, America. And unfortunately, in India, the system is set up in such a way that this sexualization is not kept in control. So I will not sugarcoat it. India is a brutal place for women. America is brutal too, but at least they can walk for the most part unharmed because the system strives.
Well, you have the infrastructure here.
Exactly. You have the infrastructure to protect the women, even though perhaps people's mindsets are not all that different in America and India. India is a brutal place for women. There is absolutely no way of sugarcoating this. I would not allow my daughter to stand at a bus stop in Delhi late night. So there's no point pretending that India is safe for women.
And it's not necessarily, I mean, some people like to say, oh, well, the caste system and, you know, it's still extant in some ways. In other words, they'll attribute this to the lower class somehow as being a rapist.
That's completely untrue. And it has nothing to do with the caste system. It has everything to do with the primal urge that men feel to subjugate women.
Why? Okay. We got some controversy going here. Let's find out what listeners have to say. Ayan is our first caller. Ayan, you're on.
Yeah, hi. My name is Ayan, and I grew up very much like Sujit. I am a born Bengali, but grew up in Bihar, which is in Ranchi, which is now Jharkhand. And I have very, very similar views like Sujit mentioned, and I just had to call in because I felt compelled to call in. The way he has written everything and he's describing it expresses my views such beautifully that I can't wait to see his plays and read his novels. I don't have a question. I just wanted to call in and say hi.
Glad you called. Glad you said hi.
And thank you for your comment.
Can we talk for a moment about Krishna's wives? I mean, all of these Krishna wives, these widows, are all destined to die and to die being unloved.
Yeah. Well, it's a little more complex. As my mother often explained to me, we are not to see Krishna's wives as wives in the true sense. When he sported in Vrindavan, he was 11 or 12.
These like nuns being wives of Christ?
No, it's not. It's actually, my mother was very, Indians, if questioned, will be very clear on that. My mother was very clear that you better not think of this as lust. And she meant it, of course. She was a very, very, religious woman who deeply believed in
this. Well, we wouldn't think of nuns as lustful either. No, just,
no. Yeah. So Krishna's wives represent, if you will, his sport and his romance and perhaps artistic abandon rather than sexual escapades. He was, after all, a teenager, and it's a little complex. Later, when he went on, he went to another place in India, in the state of Gujarat, which happens to be our Prime Minister's state, by the way, and he became king of a city named Dwarka. That is when he had 16,000 wives and 8 head wives. But it is not correct to assume that those were really his wives. He was the lord, and these women were perhaps manifestations of his manliness rather than really being wives. So it's a little complicated.
But the women in Vrindavan are wives of Krishna.
The women in Vrindavan are presumed to be his wives or his maids or his servants. And that is just a bit of a hoax perpetrated on these poor women, some of whom perhaps even believed this.
We got a caller, Lakshmi from Mountain View, who wanted to know if you think Vrindavan is good for widows and what alternate sort of ending do you suppose instead?
Oh my God,
suggest?
It's terrible for women. Unfortunately, these poor women in Vrindavan, I believe there are a few tens of thousands, perhaps have no recourse because nobody really wants them in their families. It may be fair to say that for the most part, their lives would be worse in their homes. That's not saying much. The solution does not lie in widow schemes. It lies in the way Indian society is structured.
There are many widows who are sent there, though, too.
Yes, they are sent there. As I said, they kind of have perhaps been brainwashed into half believing this hoax that they are coming here to sing the praises of the Lord and die in the arms of the Lord. They are not foolish women, but some of them do come from uneducated backgrounds. And there is no clear solution. They are perhaps marginally better off in Vrindavan than they would be in their homes. But that's not saying much.
Here's Laini. Laini, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, just want to mention that a playwright mentioned some mystery about the fascination with the white skin. And actually, there's a reason behind it. India was ruled by Afghan kings and Persian kings for many centuries. And after that came the British. And all of this time, all of these guys were lighter skin. And the mentality developed that somehow the lighter skin people are more superior, and people want to be that. So I think that is how the fascination with the white skin came about.
Yeah, but there was colonial rule by Britain throughout Africa and many parts of the world.
Well, you are partly right. Now, India's fascination with white skin goes back 2,500 years, well before we ever saw Afghans or the British. The original Indian book, the Rig Veda, was composed in 1300 before Christ. In that, there is a statement that lighter-skinned people come from...
In the Bhagavad Gita?
The Bhagavad Gita is relatively modern by Indian standards. It was written around between 200 BC to 200 AD. I'm speaking about the Rig Veda, the original Indian book. In that, the word for class is Varna. It's a Sanskrit word which literally translates to color. So the four Indian classes are literally four Indian colors, with the lighter skins being the highest color. Things got a little more complex, but India's fascination with white skin is very, very old.
Well, let me thank Laini for the call. We've got another caller on here from San Francisco. Divya, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to congratulate Mr. Saraf for bringing this play to the Bay Area. I grew up in India, and I don't remember seeing anything done on this topic of Vrindavan widows, which I feel is a very important part of our culture. I'm a North Indian, but I happened to visit the temple of Vrindavan many a time growing up. And when I was a little girl, I would look at these women and ask my parents about them, and they would just ask me to look away. And we just, we would bring blankets for them. We would give them food sometimes. But they are really in a sad and pathetic condition. And unfortunately, they still sit there outside the temple, and nothing really has changed for them. So I'm really happy that somebody is talking about it. And, this thing is being brought to light.
Well, you should be advised that the play opens September 12th and plays through the 27th at the Coverley Theater in Palo Alto, and I appreciate very much your call. Do you have a website, in fact?
Yes, we do. It is www.natak.org, and Natak is spelled N-A-A-T-A-K.
And here's another caller. And Sunny, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. Hi, Sujit. My name is Sunny Moza, and I've been listening to your talk. One thing that really struck the chord with me on how Sujit mentioned about the feminism and that how it cannot be applied genetically to across cultures and how he gave the example of his own mother. So I think that totally resonated with me. And second, I do want to say that Sujit is really very talented because he somehow takes his current affairs and writes a play so fast and so well that we all get to enjoy that.
Thank you, Sunny.
Okay, we thank you for the call. You want to talk about how you write plays so fast?
Well, I'm an engineer, and I perhaps write them as engineers write them. I plan them out like a project. It's almost a little silly, but I perhaps have an Excel spreadsheet sometimes with the exact lengths of each chapter. And I always write, when I write a novel, I always write chapter one before chapter two. I write it almost like I'm building a beautiful bench. If I write a play, I always write scene one before scene two. So my plays are not written with any kind of artistic abandon in some kind of frenzy. They're written with a very cold mind and with calculation. I know it doesn't sound right, but that's how it is.
Cold mind. All right. Here's
well, the true artist calculates, right? There is a reason the word art also means dissembling. It also means pretense. You know, the artful dodger in Dickens, he's not an artist. He's artful.
But you're an engineer who builds, yeah. And then you dissemble, as you say. So it's
part of writing is dissembling, hiding things from the reader, and so on. So I practice art as it, in my opinion, should be practiced.
And we'll hear from Lakshmi next. Lakshmi, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I'm a great fan of Natak, and I'm very glad they're doing a piece on Vrindavan. My question follows up on a previous comment about Vrindavan itself and whether it is the right place for widows in India. And also a comment on the Bollywood star, Hema Malini, who is now a turned politician. She, I believe, has raised a very important question that no one before ever did, and she should be given credit. I would like to know what your opinion on this is.
Certainly. So the first answer, of course, is the right place for widows, perhaps for anyone, is in their own homes. The second answer, you are absolutely right. Hema Malini raised the question in a very innocuous manner. If you actually listen to her, you will realize she was very sincere. She was, to be honest, trying to help these widows whom she was calling her sisters. So I don't mean to beat up on Hema Malini. She meant well. She got caught up in a controversy not of her own making and, in my opinion, beyond her understanding. I know that sounds very pompous, but I don't mean to beat up on her.
Suji Sarif with us. Quick question before we say goodbye. We've got Chloe Veltman here with us, senior arts editor for KQED, and we're going to hear some things that are coming up that you should know about. But where do you see Natak, this listener writes, 10 or 20 years from now? There's still a dearth of plays based on immigrant experiences. Will second-generation Indians be a part of the Indian theater or will be limited to new immigrants coming from
Yes,
India?
They are beginning to join. As our children grow up, perhaps Natak will be transformed and will tell what India means to my children is not what India means to me. So as Natak grows and as younger people who grew up in the U.S. join the theatre company, its mission will perhaps be transformed. But the broad mission does not change. We hope to be doing extremely serious professional plays without hopefully paying anybody. And we hope to be doing it.
Well, if you have more success, you may have to pay. But
at some point, we may have to.
But thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And good luck to you. Vrindavan, plays from September 12th to the 27th at the Cubberley Theater in Palo Alto. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Suji Sarif. And we have Chloe Veltman here, senior arts editor, KQED. First time we're meeting. Welcome.
Hello, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Delight to have you here. So tell us, you've been doing some real yo-person work in terms of finding out what's available out there in the arts world.
Absolutely. And over the next few weeks, KQED Arts is rolling out, Michael, a series of guides. And they're about a wide array of types of art happening all over the Bay Area this fall. So we take our audience through ideas for films, books that might be interesting, dance, theatre, I mean, you name it, different kinds of music. Even there's a Native American arts guide and many more subjects. And we're also doing specific guides for events in the North Bay, the South Bay and the East Bay and San Francisco. And these guides have been lovingly curated. curated by KQED's arts team of culture experts, and they're headed by our interactive producer, Kevin Jones. It's easy for people to find the collection online or on Facebook. KQED.org/fallarts is the special header that we have.
Well, online. Splendid. And people can learn a great deal from that. But do you have anything, if you were doing a kind of arts triage here, that you would put at the top of listeners' attention?
Well, there are so many things it's hard to do, but I picked a few. So, for example, in the North Bay, something that caught my eye is a lecture by Laverne Cox, who's an Emmy-nominated actress who plays Sophia on the Netflix original series Orange is the New Black. She's the first transgender woman of colour to have a leading role on a mainstream television show, and she was named as one of the top 50 trans icons by the Huffington Post. She's going to be speaking at Sonoma State University as part of the Green Music Center's Women in Leadership.
She's the transgender role, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's happening on November the 12th. Yeah, so that's something definitely in the North Bay to look out for.
And actually, we have a link on our website to all that Chloe's telling you about here. You can just go to kqed.org and find out more and find out some more detail. Anything else that you would plug or let people know about, promote?
Yeah, for example, in Sarah Hotchkiss's Visual Arts Guide, there's a great quilting exhibition that's opening at the Oakland Museum. It's called Yo-Yos and Half Squares, Contemporary California Quilts, and opens September the 12th and runs for a few months. Now, this is absolutely not your grandparents' quilt show, Michael, because you're not going to find any orderly patterns and demure fabrics here. Because
you had different grandparents. They were mine were doing quilting.
Well, there are quilts and there are quilts. So this is an exhibition of five different quilters, and they're without pattern, there's no symmetry, and they revel in this weird and garish kind of fabric that you don't normally see in a traditional quilt. For example, they're quilting with velvet, with denim jeans, and this sort of glittery polyester stuff. And quite a lot of the pieces are not square.
It's still a lost art that ought to be appreciated more.
Well, it's coming back.
Yeah, coming back in ways that no one had predicted.
Exactly.
Seconds left. Anything else off the top of the year?
Oh, yeah. I'm very excited about the Carlos Nunez appearances in the Bay Area. Now, those are happening in Felton, which is near Santa Cruz, on the 29th of September, and October the 1st in Berkeley at the Freight and Salvage. Now, Nunez is a master of an ancient and obscure Spanish bagpipe called the gaita, and he's transformed this gentle tradition instrument into something worthy of a hard rock concert, and he's super exuberant.
We had him on here years ago.
Yeah, he's wonderful. He's sort of done what for the gaita what Bela Fleck has done for the banjo.
Well, you're doing a great deal for the arts. We appreciate that. Chloe Veltman, Senior Arts Editor for KQED, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, Vinnie Tong, and Suki Lewis. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. We thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Appreciate your being here. Tomorrow, in this hour, we'll be talking to members of Duck's Breath Theater. You may remember them from back in the 70s. They are still extant. Thank you for being with us. I'm Michael Kresge.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.